KALW.
From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
I live in Oakland.
Hello from South Berkeley, below Ashby.
I live in North Richmond.
Kent Fields.
Oh, I live in San Jose, near Campbell.
Bayview.
Coming up, as housing units open up at San Francisco's Shipyard, we look back at the massive redevelopment in the city's Bayview Hunters Point neighborhood.
It all stems from really the most intensive participatory planning process that I've seen in my 20 years of doing this kind of work.
Then a local author grapples with his wife's mental illness.
And I paddled out way past the waves, and I was just kind of sitting in the middle of the open ocean, and I just sat there and I cried for a really long time, and I asked myself, is Julia gonna get better?
Gaining insight today on Cross Currents. Stay with us. This weekend, a long-awaited brand new housing development will open up in San Francisco. It's called Monarch, and it overlooks the eastern waterfront in Bayview Hunters Point. It's part of a master-planned community by Lennar Corporation that's been in the works for decades. Eventually, there will be more than 10,000 new housing units stretching along San Francisco's southeast side all the way to Candlestick Point. But this whole new neighborhood wasn't built on nothing. There's history here and plenty of controversy. A couple of years ago, KALW's Daphne Matsiaraki reported a series of stories looking in-depth at the impact of San Francisco's biggest redevelopment project. To get some perspective on what's gone into the city's newest community, let's hear her overview.
I'm standing at the top of Donahue Street on the easternmost side of San Francisco. From this hill, I've got a panoramic view. Right in front of me is the huge abandoned shipyard, the old docks, an enormous crane, and some vast empty buildings. To my right, I see Candlestick Park. Across the bay, I can see past the Port of Oakland to the hills. I trace the Bay Bridge west and end up with a stunning view of San Francisco's downtown skyline. It's a perfect spot for housing development, if you ask Danny Cook.
Well, think of the most beautiful development you'll ever see, and that's the picture.
Danny Cook is an executive vice president with Lennar Urban, the company chosen by the city of San Francisco to build the development back in 1999.
We will ultimately on Hunters Point have around 12,000 homes. We will have high-rise condo development, hotel.
There will be affordable housing and a new retail center.
We'll have a lot of amenities.
And 25 acres of public space.
And when you look at our plans, what jumps out at you initially is the amount of greenery and coastal walking paths and bicycle routes and just a beautiful environment for people to live.
At a cost of $15 billion.
As you can see from the infrastructure, that's a huge investment by Lennar.
And it's taken a long time.
The project has been around the drawing boards for around 20 years. And as you can see from the size of the development like this, there's a lot of issues.
In order to understand why it's taken so long and how the project is affecting the people who live in this part of the city, we need to consider how we got to this point.
I figured this would be a better place. Yes, it's quiet.
Of course, and it's a local church.
I have grandkids at home.
I'm meeting a longtime resident of Bayview Hunters Point here at St. John's Missionary Church.
Okay, my name is Oscar James, born and raised in Bayview Hunters Point on Navy Road. 1946.
James's father worked in the shipyard until 1956, and he got a job there himself in the 70s.
A lot of people working in the shipyard. When Eisenhower became president, that's when a lot of people started getting laid off in the shipyard. They were downsizing. A lot of people lived in Hunters Point, South Basin, Betrayal Hill. Everybody was making money, having fun. It was a mixed community at that particular time, with all different races that was here in the community.
Many African Americans migrated from the South to work in the shipyard. In 1950, African Americans made up about a quarter of the Hunters Point population. That grew to over 50% in 1960 and nearly 80% by 1970. But in 1974, the Navy left the shipyard.
A lot of people's lost their jobs.
Thousands. Unemployment levels in Bayview Hunters Point quadrupled in the years following the closure.
It had a dramatic effect on the residents of Bayview Hunters Point.
By 1991, the shipyard was completely shuttered. How it would be repurposed made residents like James worried. Back in the 50s and 60s, African Americans were displaced from the Fillmore and Western Addition in the name of redevelopment.
But the whole concern has never really been about the residents of Bayview Hunters Point. We've always had to fight for our home.
And that's how the idea of the community being involved with the redevelopment was born. James shows me a letter from 1973 written by community members addressed to Joseph Aliotto, the mayor of San Francisco at the time. In the letter, residents laid down their idea of creating a new town in town after the shipyard would close down.
That was a paper that I was requesting different facilities in the shipyard.
They wanted housing, a theater, a bowling alley, a church. But instead of development, the community has witnessed deterioration. Nearly half of its population lives below the federal poverty level. James says,
Bayview Hunters Point has always been a black eye to the city and county of San Francisco.
Despite the need to revitalize the shipyard, it wasn't until 1993, 20 years after the Navy left, that the city announced redevelopment was officially happening. Immediately, a citizens' advisory committee was created. Its aim was to hold any developers accountable to neighborhood residents. The CAC's offices are inside the construction site.
People were complaining about environmental issues, about the dust and all like that. And those are the kinds of issues that we hear, but we don't hear them as often now that the project has gone vertical.
Dr. Veronica Hanicutt is chair of the CAC.
So we have had an opportunity to hear people express their concerns.
She describes how the design process worked at one of the apartment buildings.
They actually looked at the project and made their recommendations, and many of those recommendations were actually folded into the design of that particular building. So when the community comes together with the design team and with the city and county of San Francisco and their representatives, that wonderful positive things can be done.
It all stems from the most intensive participatory planning process that I've seen in my 20 years of doing this kind of work.
Thor Kozlowski is the project manager for the Hunters Point Shipyard for the San Francisco Office of Community, Investment and Infrastructure. It's a long title for the former redevelopment agency. According to Kozlowski, they changed the name to dissociate the agency from the failures of the past.
We have almost 300 acres of parks out here throughout the whole project, tons of housing.
Kozlowski says the community participated in all the planning and design details.
All of that sort of laid out in creating what we call a design for development document, and it's a planning document that replaces the zoning code for this area, and it sets the height limits and the kinds of buildings that should be out here and the form. That's one level. So that took, years.
What's underneath the surface of this land, he says, also delayed the implementation of the project. That's the legacy of the Navy's work, which left a Superfund site.
The Navy's cleanup program and the transfer program is subject to federal funding. So the Navy can only clean up as fast as they get funding for. They had spent up to date since 1992 about $850 million.
Across town at City Hall, Bayview Hunters Point Supervisor Malia Cohen says that what's going on in the shipyard has been very deliberate.
There's a contract, an official contract signed with the developer and the city, and then there's a social compact that's also been signed. So there are a lot of people that are watching this project.
Lennar promises the shipyard will be clean of its toxic waste, there will be thousands of new jobs, and there will be affordable housing.
As long as I'm here, I'm committed to ensuring that people are treated with respect, with dignity, and definitely not displaced.
Back at St. John's Missionary Church, Oscar James is showing me photographs of the people who have fought for these values in the shipyard throughout the years.
Well, I believe they're keeping the majority of the promises that we've demanded. We made them do a different job when they came here. We made them. And when I say we made them, we told them they're not coming in doing what they did in Western Addition. We have seen what they did in Western Addition. But the peoples in Western Addition were not together.
The future will depend on the extent to which the City of San Francisco and Lennar keep their promises, so that the residents are given a real chance to stay and be a part of the new Bayview Hunters Point shipyard that they've waited for so long. In San Francisco, I'm Daphne Mazziaracchi for CrossCurrents.
That story originally aired in 2014. Thor Koslowski no longer works with the City of San Francisco, though he still works in urban development. And there are several other key updates to that story. Last year, the U.S. Nuclear Regulatory Commission fined Navy contractor Tetra Tech for falsifying some soil samples. Also, some former contractors testing the shipyard for radioactivity have alleged fraud in the cleanup, saying computer data regarding radiation levels was tampered with. The Navy and oversight agencies are now testing 70,000 soil samples, and they plan to release their findings this summer. If you're interested in taking a look for yourself, the Navy's offering bus tours of its cleanup of its former naval base at Hunters Point Shipyard on Saturday, August 5th. You can find the details at kalw.org, click CrossCurrents. And then tune into CrossCurrents next Monday. We'll look at Lennar's planned redevelopment at the former naval base on Treasure Island. You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Hannah Baba. Our next story is brought to us by our friends at The Moth, a live storytelling podcast. Mark Lukacs is a writer, teacher, and surfer living in the Bay Area. He has a new book out called My Lovely Wife in the Psych Ward, a memoir. He tells the story of confronting his wife's unexpected mental illness in a transformative moment he had in the chilly waters of Ocean Beach.
I came home from work one day, and I found my wife sitting on the floor in the guest room, and she wouldn't look up at me. And I had learned to read her body language well enough to know that when she wouldn't look up at me, she had something she was really lost in. And finally, after a little while, I coaxed it out of her. What's wrong? And she said, I've been thinking about what I'm going to do with the Vespa key. I didn't know what she was talking about. We have a Vespa, but... And so she said, when I go to the Golden Gate Bridge, I need to take the scooter to get there. And when I jump off the bridge, I don't know what I'm going to do with the Vespa key. I could leave it on the scooter, but then someone might steal it. And I could bring the key with me, but they might not find my body. And then you lose the scooter too. So I've been thinking about what to do with the Vespa key. Now, I had been terrified that my wife might act on her suicidal impulses. I had hid her medication. I changed the hiding place every few days. But I didn't know exactly how I was supposed to hide the Golden Gate Bridge. I met and fell in love with my wife, Julia, when I was 18. And when you're 18, you don't think about the future very much. And when I thought about it, I thought it was going to be bright and shiny. I didn't think that someday this person that I love so much was going to get really sick, and that she was going to experience so much pain, and that I was going to spend so much time afraid and worried about whether she would live or die. We married young, and we had these incredibly charmed lives, and everything started to change when she took on a new job. And the stress she had to the work quickly became something much bigger than just normal work stress. It first manifested itself in not being able to sleep at night. And I would try to stay up with her, and I'd try to talk to her and give her massages and tell her, just relax, it's okay. And then I'd fall asleep, and I'd wake up, and she'd still be sitting on the bed staring at me. And all I wanted to do was help, and I couldn't do anything. And then one morning when I woke up, she said, God spoke to me last night. And he said, everything's going to be okay, and I'm going to be fine. which was unsettling to hear, but it was also at least comforting. And then a few days later, I woke up and she wasn't sitting on the bed. She was frantically pacing around the room. And when I finally cornered her, she said, "I spoke to the devil last night. He said, it's not going to be okay. He said, I'm not getting better. He said, I'm not worth getting better." And I didn't know what to do. I was completely over my head. And so I took her to the hospital and I had to literally grab her. But she was kicking and screaming and trying to grab onto doorknobs in order to get her into the car to take her to the hospital. And once we got there, they admitted her to the psych ward. And let me just tell you, the psych ward is just as horrifying as it looks in the movies, with the blank white walls and the bars on the windows and the little cups with medicine. And I visited her every day from 7 to 8:30 during visiting hours. Sometimes she didn't want me to visit. She was scared that if I came close to her, this thing that was inside her might get me too. And so in this perverse way, she was trying to protect me while I was trying to protect her. And I didn't know what to do, so I did everything, because I thought somehow maybe I could love this thing out of her. Maybe I could say the right thing to her, or I could hold her close enough, or I could ask the right questions to the doctors, and I could somehow make this go away. But the days added up to weeks, and I had realized I couldn't. And the doctors were perplexed. She had no previous hint of a mental illness, and here she was. And as they described her, she was acutely psychotic. So one afternoon before the hospital visit, I went out surfing, and I didn't even really feel like surfing. I just needed to be in the ocean, and I paddled out way past the waves, and I was just kind of sitting in the middle of the open ocean, and I just sat there, and I cried for a really long time, and I asked myself, is Julia going to get better, or is this it for us? Because I didn't really sign up for this when I was 18. I don't know if I can do this. And this is going to sound like a cliche, but you have to believe me, this actually happened. Two dolphins swam right at me. And I heard, and they were right there on my right. They swam right under, and they were on my left. I looked at these dolphins, and I thought of how vast and terrifying the ocean is, and I saw them swimming together, and I knew then that if they could do it, so could I. And I was going to stand by my wife no matter what. No matter what, it turned out to be 23 days in the psych ward. And when she came home, she was very heavily medicated. And the medication changed her. It slowed her down. I'd ask her a question, and she'd often have to repeat the question to make sure she understood it. And then her answer was often just yes or no. Some of it actually changed her physically, made her stiff, like arms frozen at her side. And some of the medication led to really rapid weight gain. And the worst thing it did was to her eyes, these beautiful brown eyes that I looked in and fell in love with. When I looked in them now, there was nothing. It was just looking in the eyes of a non-person. But, you know, we did what we could. We took one day at a time. We trotted along. We tried to tackle the problems we could actually solve. Like, for example, the weight gain. Julia hated the weight gain. And I thought, this is something I can do. I can do something about this. So I found a nearby gym, and I called them, and they're only $10 a month. So I signed us up, and they did group classes, and she loved group classes before she got sick. So we went to our first class, and this gym was $10 a month. It was pretty horrible. It had bright red wall-to-wall carpeting and rusted machines and a tanning booth, and it was just... But we went to the class, and I don't even remember what the class was called, but it was basically an aerobics class. And it was all old Chinese women and us. And the teacher was an old Chinese woman, and she didn't speak English very well. And I think she mostly made up what she was doing as she did it. So we had no idea what, we're just kind of trying to keep up and follow along. And I got to be honest, it was awesome. Like, it was so much fun because it was just the right amount of absurdity and bizarreness that it could get me out of my life. But the thing was, in aerobics class, I had to do my best to not watch Julia. Because in that class, her slowness and the physical manifestations of her illness were most obviously on display. Now, when she was discharged, I took 3 months off work in order to stay home and take care of her, and I thought 3 months is going to be plenty of time. Well, she'll be fine. And after 3 months, I had to go back to work to keep up my insurance, and she wasn't fine at all. She was, you could say, worse, because she was openly suicidal at that point. And so I go to work and basically panic all day, and then I come home and pretend everything was fine and dance around the house and be goofy and just try to keep life light for her and for me. And this was our life for months. You know, for months, I was her cheerleader and I was her watchman, but I was also terrified and I was slowly falling apart inside. And for months, the doctors, they experimented with so many combinations of drugs and different tweak this and change that and get rid of this, and nothing was working. Finally, after 9 months, they sat me down and they said, "We think it's time we consider ECT. ECT stands for electroconvulsive therapy. And I know that a lot has changed since the 60s and One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, but when they said to me they wanted to give my wife shock treatment, that's when I knew I was at the edge, and I once again feared, is Julia ever going to get better? But they said, we're going to give it one last try. We're going to give one last drug combination, another shot, before we go that route, and hope for the best. 2 weeks later, we're in that aerobics class. And I look in one of the mirrors, and I see Julia, and she's smiling. You have to understand how rarely she smiled. I smiled back, and I stopped, and I watched her for a little bit. And she was less slow. She was more in control of her body. She was coming back. And I turned and I faced her and I looked in her eyes. For the first time in 9 months, I saw life again. I saw this spark of health that we all take for granted so much. And I knew she was going to make it. And I turned back to that aerobics teacher and I kept going so hard. I thought my arms were going to fall out of their socket. I was so victorious. I met and I fell in love with my wife when I was 18. And I had no idea how demanding and scary love is, how much it asks of us. You know, I had no idea she would get sick. And she has bipolar disorder, which is a lifelong illness. It's going to always be part of her. It's going to always be part of me. You know, I didn't think about that this person is going to someday die. You don't think about that when you're a kid. And I knew that would happen, but I didn't process it. And I clearly have a preference for what that looks like. I want us to make it into old age, but ultimately, I don't have that much of a say. My wife's mental illness has added tremendous layers of sadness and uncertainty and fear into our lives. But it's also shown me that there truly is no greater reward than to love someone and to be loved in return. To lose someone into the deepest depths of depression and then to find yourself at aerobics class surrounded by old Chinese women in a room with bright red carpeting and to look into her eyes and then see that she was going to be okay. Thank you.
That was Mark Lukacs, author of My Lovely Wife in the Psych Ward, a memoir. You can find more first-person storytelling like that at themoth.org. And if you'd like to see some live performances yourself, consider coming out to the Sights and Sounds of Richmond event this Sunday. KLW is partnering with other organizations to showcase the arts of the city. For more information, go to our website, klw.org, click Cross Currents. And that's all for the show today. Our Cross Currents team includes Nina Gensler-Debs, Gabriel Greshler, Angela Johnston, Zoe Liu, Lisa Morehouse, Ariel Plotnick, Judy Silber, and Andrew Stelzer. The show is engineered by James Rollins. Our line producer is Hannah Kingsley Ma. Jen Chien is our managing editor. Ben Trefney is our news director. Our opening theme music is by the John Santos Quintet.
Well, you got to read.
You got to read.
Just what you sow.
Just what you sow.
Not many performers are still active at 90, which makes East Bay resident Barbara Dane's upcoming birthday celebration all the more special. Barbara Dane will be joined by the Chambers Brothers at Minor Auditorium in the SF Jazz Center on Thursday. For Cross Currents, I'm Hannah Baba.
Just what you sow, what you sow. You got to reap,
you got to reap.
Just what you sow,
just what you sow.
You got